Good morning. Before I start, I'd just like to thank the Chaplains Association for inviting me here to address you this morning. You can relax because I'm basically your garden variety type member of the church. I have a testimony of the Book of Mormon, which is very strong, and it's a testimony I received as a teenage boy, and that's why I know the Book of Mormon is true. Though the things I hope to show you today, which I'll show you just a brief part of because it's really a two-hour presentation, simply are of interest to me and firm up and give me understanding of what Lehi went through, but it's not what I base my testimony of. That's the witness I received from the Holy Ghost as a 17-year-old boy. I did serve a mission, but really don't think of me anything more than just a regular member of the church. The only thing that maybe distinguishes me from somebody else is the fact I'm kind of a ringleader for a group of saints who live in Saudi Arabia. As you chaplains must know, wherever you take Latter-day Saints brothers and sisters alike, they're not a precarious people, they're a curious people. They love to search for the truth under any rock in any desert. And, you know, sometimes they get themselves in trouble. But they're curious, and we're always out looking for things. And those of you who have been in the Middle East, you know it's at times a little boring over there, especially the kind of wild soldiers. They don't know what to do with themselves. And I used to teach for the University of Maryland as just a side thing at Khobar Towers, and I'd go and I'd take some of the soldiers and bring them into town because they didn't have vehicles, they didn't have any way of getting around. I wanted to show them how special the Saudi people were. And it was a great honor to do that. But we are kind of a curious people, and I'm kind of the leader of this group trying to go out into the desert and look for things. And we didn't go out there with an agenda. We weren't looking even for evidences of the Book of Mormon. We were simply out looking for other biblical sites. Now, one thing that distinguishes me from the other members of the church in Saudi Arabia is I don't work for the oil company. I don't work for Raytheon, an American company. I work for the Saudi Electricity Company. And their philosophy is, if you come to our country, you need to be with our people. So they don't give me a nice housing compound with a big fence around it, and it's Mesa, Arizona on the inside. 11 of the 13 years I've been in Saudi Arabia, I have lived in Dammam or Khobar, among the people. Where I work, I am the only Westerner. I am surrounded by hundreds of Muslims who would love to convert me, and they are wonderful people. And so I have very close relationships. I'm the only Christian among, the only non-Saudi among the 500 people at the institute that I work for. Now, I'm saying that because I want to share with you some genuine comments from my friends. These are not PR statements that Saudis tell people. It's at quiet moments when we've been talking together and they've shared with me their sentiments about the United States of America and its soldiers. The U.S. soldiers are God's angels, the full statement is, who came out of the skies to help us. That was the mother of one of the Saudis who goes out into the deserts with us looking for evidences of the Book of Mormon. Let me tell you a little bit about this gentleman. He's a devout Muslim. He has the Book of Mormon in four different languages in his office. He's a very wealthy Saudi. He sent two of his nephews to BYU. Now, and my wife just loved this. He said, Sister Potter, to be frank with you, the English translation of the Book of Mormon ain't much. It's a pretty boring book. I don't know how you can read it. But let me tell you, the Arabic, the original language of the Book of Mormon, when I got my Arabic copy of the Book of Mormon, I could not set it down. I read it through lunch. My wife called me for dinner. I would not put it down. I did not finish that book until I had put it down until I'd read it completely. It is so beautiful in its original language. He's a character. Some of you people, I mean, he goes out in the desert with us, and he and I usually go out because we're very close friends, and then it's whoever's available that weekend or that week. Last year, we were out with David Alexander, the stake president. Those of you who are serving in Iraq know David Alexander, wonderful man. He holds, I guess, the ecclesiastic keys for the priesthood over Iraq. And every time he gives me a funny look, I says, I'm not going to be the high councilman for Iraq, just in Baghdad. Just don't look at me that way. But he is really devoted to serving the servicemen there and shares with us many of the stories he gets. He says sometimes 150 emails a week to try to handle the ecclesiastic affairs for the soldiers there. And he really is a good man. But we're out in the desert looking for evidences of the tribe called Lehi that is still there in Arabia. It's a tribe who changed its name from the Dedanites to the Lehiites in the 6th century BC, the exact time Lehi was going through Arabia. And we know that Nephi said, or the Doctrine and Covenant says that Nephi was a missionary in Arabia. So we're out looking for evidence for this. And I'm with my friend Faisal. We're driving his truck. I'm in the front seat. President Alexander's in the back. He says, Faisal says, President Alexander, I'm really upset. I haven't seen George for 3 months. As my home teacher, he's supposed to come see me. You tell him to come see me more often. Well, maybe I can add him to my statistics then. Okay, let's look at some of these other quotes. Without the U.S., we would never have peace in my country. I don't know if you realize how much good, which honor and power the U.S. servicemen bring to the world. This is a PhD from USC. He is Sudanese, and he's very much involved with the government of Sudan. He says, without the United States, we could have never had peace in our land. We've had decades of war. Finally, good things can happen to our country, but only because of the United States. In every Arab's heart, they pray the U.S. soldiers will come to their country to make life better for them. That's an iman, the guys with the long beard and the short skirts. You know, we wish, we all pray that they would come to our country. Now, a sideline of that is another guy said to me, George, and this is after 22 people were killed in my compound where I live by terrorists. He says, you know, we're very, very sorry, George, but you understand we need one or two Americans to be killed every year, but not you. Not you. We love you, and we don't want anybody to get killed. But, you know, we need one or two Americans to get killed every year. If a Frenchman dies, who cares? If a Chinaman dies, no one cares. But if an American dies, the phone rings in Riyadh, and our country makes changes. Only the President of the United States of America can get on the phone and make changes in Saudi Arabia. Don't take us wrong. We love you, but we have to have some Americans killed every year. That way, we will see change in our country. Okay. And here's a quote which I loved, okay, from a guy one day came to me and says, you know, what the Americans are doing in Iraq is perfect. Perfect. You don't hear that in the news. Perfect. These are Saudis. This picture was taken last week. I was doing some research on the Frankincense Trail. It went from Baghdad over to the town of Dedan through Arabia. And we came within 25 miles of the Iraqi border. I want you to know that my own work over there cannot be possible without you servicemen. And we keep you, every American and Filipino and everybody else who's a member of the church in Arabia, keep you in our prayers. And we thank you for protecting us. Okay, maybe we're just members of the church, but we've spent tens of thousands of hours looking for the Book of Mormon. We look at all the group, especially Richard Willington, and I have done a lot of research in the libraries and so forth there. But basically, we just go out and photograph what is there. And then we put together in a book a couple years ago. We are basically amateurs, but what do the scholars say about what we're doing? Because we don't purport to be experts in anything. This is Dr. Hugh Nibley, and one of the greatest honors that I had was him asking me to talk to him. Can you imagine that? What an honor that was, and to go into his office. And we became very good friends. He endorsed our book. After this, Lehi in the Wilderness, those who challenge the Book of Mormon will have some heavy explaining to do. J. Todd, editor of the Ensign, you have taken Book of Mormon archaeology to an entirely new level. He's now retired as editor of the Ensign. S. Kent Brown, who took Hugh Nibley's place as chair of the Ancient Studies program at BYU, any student of the Book of Mormon has to take their efforts seriously. In an email to us, he stated, "You have found it all." It's a pretty big statement. We have found it all. If you'd like to follow what we do, we have a website, and we keep updating it, www.nephiproject.com. You can go there and sign up for a free newsletter, which we send out monthly. I said we're just back from near Iraq, up in northwestern Arabia. We'll be reporting that. But it's a way in which we keep people posted. You can also find out about our books and films there if you're interested. Now, one thing we're going to start, my partner Tim Sedor and I, we decided we're going to put an Iraqi page. Because I've been in Arabia 13 years, and I just love to go to Iraq. You know, if I could just get my wife to say yes and escort. I mean, Iraq is so full of antiquities that relate to our faith. And so Lee Nelson, who's an author in the church, his daughter's serving there. She's going to start to send us some photographs and articles about where she is posted, which is at Ur of Chaldees. She's a medic there. And so we're going to offer anybody who's in the military who would love to share the LDS community photographs of the biblical sites there or inspiring stories or anything else. We're going to put an Iraq page on there. So that might be of interest to people. To your people. What were we doing in northwest corner of Saudi Arabia? We were looking for Mount Sinai. Okay? And I see that Chaplain Horton has flown around it several times and did so before I even got there. Well, we didn't have a transport plane to do it in. We had to do it on the ground. And it took five efforts to actually find the mountain that we think is Mount Sinai. Well, we have since traced the whole trail. While we were doing that, we ended up in this area looking for the trail of the Exodus, and we came across a valley. Okay, you're a garden variety member of the church, and you end up looking for Mount Sinai, and you find yourself in a valley that looks an awful lot like the description of Nephi's Valley of Lemuel. You ask yourself, well, what am I doing here, and what do I do now? Well, we did write it up, and it was published by Farms BYU in their November Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. There's not one serious LDS scholar who doesn't accept this as being the best candidate for the Valley of Lemuel to date. So why is it important that we have a qualified candidate for the Valley of Lemuel? Well, critics of the Book of Mormon loved to try to find errors in the Book of Mormon. Okay, you know, they spent a whole lot more time looking for errors than we do looking for the truth in it. So they have us pinned down there. You know, don't they? You know, if it's something to do with the New World, we just say, well, maybe there are elephants up in New York, or maybe they're the ones down in the temple in Cusco, Peru, where I served as a missionary, the elephant bones down there. We can always kind of shift to, you know, like a pea game. They got us tied down. They know it came down from Jerusalem, camped by the Red Sea. There has to be a river by the Red Sea. And then they went south, southeast, so they have to be in Arabia. They can't be on the other side. They'd be in the water. Then they built a ship down in Oman, where there's never been timber where you can build a ship with. So they got us pinned down. And here's just a couple of critics of the Book of Mormon who have said, oh, it's got geographical areas, errors. Everybody knows there are no rivers in Arabia. Go to the CIA website, no rivers. Go to the Saudi Arabian Atlas of Water Resources after a 44-year survey from the U.S. Geological Survey. No perennial rivers or streams. Where's the River of Laman? Where's this great valley? Where are these trees you could build a ship with? Dr. Eugene England from Stanford, who's a member, if the story claims to be literally true, which I've always been told, or my mother had spanked me, of course it's literally true. It's not some nice novel that Joseph Smith has put together to inspire us. Is it literally true? It must hold up against all the sequential, a little bit early in the morning. Okay, 150 years of detailed scientific exploration. Now, at the time we started, I can be blunt by saying it didn't. From what science was saying, the Book of Mormon didn't hold up to what was known about Arabia. Because actually very little was known, to tell you the truth. Okay, instead of lecturing you about this, what I'd like to do is now take you to Arabia. We're going to start at where the wilderness started. You know Iraq, the Fertile Crescent. Politically, geographically, the wilderness started at the northern tip of Aqaba in Antiquities. That's clear to any student of the Book of Mormon or any student of Antiquities. That's where the wilderness began. Let's start there, and let's drive down into Arabia using Nephi's instructions. Could we have the video, please?
The particular waste in which Lehi made his first camp is among the most uninviting deserts on earth. Detestable certainly describes the place. United States Geological Survey and Saudi Arabian Department of Water Resources concluded, Saudi Arabia may be the world's largest country without any perennial rivers or streams. Where is the fertile valley of Lemuel in a land described as hell? And where is its river of flowing water in riverless Arabia?
I became determined to find Lehi's trail to the River of Lehman. Let's start at the Gulf of Aqaba and use only the Book of Mormon as our guide.
Nephi's characteristics of the Valley of Lemuel. From what George had read in the Book of Mormon, he reasoned that the Valley of Lemuel must be a mountain canyon. Nephi wrote that the valley was in the borders, which meant the mountains. The Arabic word for mountain is Jebel, which conjugates in Hebrew as Jebel, which means the borders. The mountains in northwest Arabia are called the Hejaz. That literally means in English, the barriers or borders. Nephi wrote that the valley was in the borders, meaning the valley was in the mountains. Since the Valley of Lemuel was in the mountains, it must have been a canyon. Second, we knew that the valley had a small stream flowing continually through it. Nephi indicated that it was a river of water. Dr. Nibley clarified for us what this meant. Dr. Nibley notes, the expression river of water is used only for small local streams. The River of Laman must have been a small local stream, no name known to Lehi. It cannot, therefore, have been an important stream, let alone one of the most remarkable on earth, or Lehi would have known about it. Third, the Valley of Lemuel opened onto the Fountain of the Red Sea. The footnote in the Book of Mormon suggests it was on the Gulf of Aqaba, which is in the Red Sea. Fourth, the Valley of Lemuel was very fertile. Nephi wrote that they gathered many kinds of fruits and even grain. However, Saudi Ministry of Agriculture has classified all the lands near the shore of the Gulf of Aqaba as 0% arable due to poor soil and rocky conditions. What instructions did Nephi give us for finding the Valley of Lemuel? He wrote that they traveled in the borders. If we replace the term borders with mountains, we read, and he came down by the mountains near the shore of the Red Sea, and he traveled in the wilderness in the mountains, which are nearer the Red Sea. Note that Nephi first wrote that they traveled by the mountains, and then in the mountains. The mountains they traveled in were the mountains nearer the Red Sea. Nephi indicates that the wilderness they traveled in had two mountain ranges both near the Red Sea. Indeed, this is exactly what is found in Midian, where there is one mountain range near the Red Sea and one nearer the Red Sea, with mountains ascending to over 6,000 feet. The Valley of Lemuel was in the mountains nearer the Red Sea. Finally, Nephi wrote that they arrived at the river after traveling 3 days in the wilderness. In biblical times, the land known as the wilderness started near what is today the port of Aqaba at the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba. Lehi could only have traveled in Arabia with tents and provisions if he had camels. A camel can travel between 20 and 25 miles per day, depending on load and terrain. This meant that their campsite by the river must have been somewhere between 60 and 75 miles from the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba, and somewhere in the shoreline mountains. Does the trail Nephi described lead to a canyon with a stream? We were ready. The next morning we would follow Nephi's directions and see where they led us. As we traveled into Arabia, we found the terrain just as Nephi had described it, that they came down by the borders near the shore of the Red Sea. On our right were the waters of the Gulf of Aqaba of the Red Sea. Before us, excellent terrain for camels to travel, and on our immediate left were mountains. Nephi's initial instructions worked for about 45 miles. Then the passage along the shoreline ended. Here the mountains fall directly into the Red Sea. So what did Nephi say they did next? They traveled in the borders or mountains. We were not surprised then that the only wadi or valley into these mountains was found within a mile of where the mountains reached the sea. If we were on Lehi's trail, the prophet would have had only one choice, to enter this valley. But did this wadi lead to a river? We needed to see where this valley led, if anywhere. We were anxious on entering the wadi. If it failed any of our tests, it could not have been the one used by Lehi to reach the Valley of Lemuel. First, it had to lead somewhere, either to a river or to another passage through the mountains. If it dead-ended, like most wadis do in this area, it meant that Nephi's instructions did not apply to this area. Second, we knew that the maximum distance Lehi could have traveled in 3 days was approximately 75 miles. This is only true provided they crossed good terrain for camels. If the terrain turned rocky or the trail led over mountaintops, then 75 miles was way beyond their reach in 3 days. So far, the shoreline and this wadi would have provided a fast trail for camels. As the passage twisted its way through the mountains, we were amazed at how it kept a level course. However, we were afraid that around any bend, it might dead end. It didn't. It just kept going deeper and deeper into the mountains. By the time we reached the end of the wadi, we were 6 miles east into the mountains and 3 miles south from where we left the shoreline. The wadi proved to be a passage through the mountains to a rise where it opened into another wadi that headed south. George knew the shoreline mountains of Midian as a giant maze of intertwined mountains. Yet, here before us was a U-shaped wadi that led straight through the shoreline mountains. We learned later that the name of this valley was the Wadi Tayyib al-Isim. We headed down through the wadi to see where it led. We noticed 3 interesting characteristics of the Wadi Tayyib al-Isim. First, it had no exits. If Lehi entered this valley, he undoubtedly would have followed it to its end. Second, it provided an excellent footing for camels. Third, as we followed it down through the mountains, We were quickly coming to our limit of 75 miles, and what we were seeing was typical Midian landscape. No water, no vegetation to speak of, certainly no fruit trees. At this point, the wadi took a sudden turn to the west and headed for the tall shoreline mountains. Here, we expected the wadi to dead end. Instead, we found an oasis of date palms. The Arabs have a saying that the date palm has its feet in the water and its head in the fire. On seeing the palms, Lehi would have known that he had found a supply of water and food for his family. And how did we come upon this fertile valley? We followed exactly Nephi's instructions. However, the wadi did not end at the oasis. There is a great crack in the granite mountains that separates the oasis from the Red Sea, a canyon of pure granite. Within a few hundred yards of entering the canyon, we came to a true discovery, a springhead that fed a small desert river. Here was a stream of pure water flowing through a spectacular canyon formed from one of the hardest rocks on earth.
How do we know that the river flows all year round? I have visited the river 7 times, including the rainy season and in the driest part of summer, once after it hadn't rained for 14 months.
And we're in the valley in which the river is found. It is made of solid granite, one of the hardest rocks on earth. This valley can only be described as firm, steadfast, and immovable.
Lehi's family gathered seeds and fruit of many kinds, and also grain. Hundreds of date palms graced the canyon and the oasis in the upper valley. All 3 species of date palms are found in the valley. Delicious teen berries also grow in the canyon. Lehi's family could have collected other seeds and fruits, and we found grain growing in the valley in 5 separate places. Is there any evidence that Lehi and his family stayed in this valley? Perhaps. On the north side of the oasis, just outside the canyon, is found the ruins of what appears to be a large permanent campsite. Lehi would have built windbreaks, storage areas, and tables and utility walls out of stone. Finding an antiquities site in the valley raised questions. Had archaeologists visited the site? What was it? And how old were these ruins? In search for the answers to these questions, George Potter traveled to King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals in Saudi Arabia. He knew that a team of international archaeologists had surveyed Northwest Arabia in 1980, and with the help of Bedouin guides, had discovered almost 200 antiquity sites. George's research led him to the archaeological collection of the main library. Volume 5, Saudi Arabian Archaeology, had the information he needed. The ruins in the Wadi Tayyib al-Ism had been visited by the survey team in 1980. They had classified them as, quote, an encampment, end quote, and cataloged them as archaeological site number 200-81. The archaeologists reported that they found surface artifacts at site 200-81, including stone enclosures, stone monuments, and pottery shards. We also found pottery shards at the encampment and questioned their age. The archaeologists classified the pottery at site as Iron Age Midian and Hellenistic. They defined the Iron Age for this region as late 2nd to mid 1st millennium BC. We now knew that the campsite dated back to at least the time of Lehi. One other man-made feature caught the eye of Richard Wellington from England, a small stone box buried in the floor of the canyon.
Much of our work was trying to figure out how Lehi would have gone through Arabia. And all I really had to do is go down to the office next to me and talk to Walid al-Mansur, whose grandfather was a caravaneer. How'd they travel through Arabia in ancient times? Well, there's only one way. There's only one trail. That's been confirmed by our work in the library studying the golden age of Islamic geographers. There's only one trail through Arabia, and you had to take that trail because that's the only place you could find water. Also, if you left that trail, you would be summarily executed. And all you guys who are out there in Iraq know every Bedou is a spy, right? They get bashish for reporting anybody who's traveling through the country. Lehi had to take the frankincense trail. There is just no doubt in anybody's mind, any serious archaeologist, if one went through Arabia in 600 BC or 587 BC, they had to have been on the Gaza Bank, the frankincense trail, which went within 10 miles of this canyon. That trail was quoted by Jeremiah, it was quoted by Ezekiel, and certainly Lehi was probably a merchant. He would have known about the trail. Did he take that trail? Is there evidence that he did? This is the trail. You see the one coming down from Baghdad across. That's the one we're doing research on last week. There's one that came down from Damascus, and then there's the Gaza branch, went by the valley. They all joined at Dedan. Then they came down in a single trail. Then they kind of broke up down southern Arabia. The final branch going east to a place called Korori, which is the harbor for the frankincense. The frankincense at that time was similar to crude oil of today. It was the most precious item in the entire world. Over 3,000 tons were burned in the temples in Baghdad alone. It was also burned in the temples of Jerusalem. And they made a business out of this. They maintained that trail. And there were halts along those trails, which you could best equate to truck halts or truck stops along I-15. Okay, they were maintained. The trails, you could go down. Now, why is that interesting? The first trail past the valley, see, the caravaneers, you'd have to go from one halt, they called it, to the next. You could not stop and pitch tents. You'd have to just get authorization to go through that section of the trail. You'd normally have a scout to take you there. Once you got to a halt where there was a well, you could pitch your tents. The first halt past what we think is the Valley of Lemuel is a place called Wadi Agar on maps today. It's not always been called that. Those of you in the Air Force know what a tactical pilotage chart is, right? It shows you all the detail of the landscape. There's only one place in that whole area of northwest Arabia where it says look for trees on those charts. That's at the first halt past the valley. In other words, the first place Lehi could have stopped after he left the valley was at that halt. They could have put their camels down, rolled up in rugs, but they couldn't pitch tents. They had to keep going and going. Then they could halt. And maybe they'd go hunting. Nephi says, and they went and they stopped. They went 4 days south-southeast direction, and they stopped in a place called Shazer. That would have been the first halt along that trail. Okay, Shazer, according to Hugh Nibley, is the place of the trees. However, back in the 6th century B.C., it would have been spelled differently because languages change. And in the old records, same meaning trees, Sigur. Now, you know in Arabic, we have some people here who speak Arabic, okay? You know that Arabic in a written form does not have vowels. You have to put the vowels in to match the context of what's being said. So we can replace the vowels Sigur. Now, were there really two spellings? How accurate is Hugh Nibley? This is a French map of southern Arabia. Down at the bottom there, where we're going to go down and look for Banifol, which also had fruit trees, we see the map calling it Sigur or Shazer. Both pronunciations, there's a close-up of that. My goodness, let's go back up to northern Arabia. This is a very uncommon name. We've only seen it in two places in Arabia. And a little box there, there's Gulf of Aqaba, where that valley is located. South-southeast is a place called Sizer, okay, or Shazer, just as Nephi indicates. Again, it's the only place in that whole area where pilots are told to look for trees. That wadi has thousands of trees in it. It extends for 5 miles. Doesn't sound much here, but there it's a lot of trees. Okay, natural trees. We're also told by the police chief of the area it's the best place to hunt. And that's why they stopped to hunt. And we didn't ask him that question. He just told us, why are you taking that road? Take this road. It has the best hunting in the whole area. No wonder Lehi stopped there. They're going into the wilderness, get some meat. Then, I love this part. This is one of the most intriguing parts of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith was a farmer. He translated the Book of Mormon. He said that once they left Shazer, Nephi records, we did travel in the most fertile parts of the wilderness. The most fertile parts of Saudi Arabia? Come on now. I mean, the other stuff's easy, man. He's a farmer. If you look at the Webster's 1928 edition of his dictionary, there's a very specific mean of fertile. It's where you could grow crops and get fruit. Now, we left what we call Shazer. We traveled this way for 75 miles. It looked like we're in the surface of the moon. We're following the trail. We're the first Westerners to actually retrace, probably the first people ever since antiquity, to retrace the Gaza branch of the Frankincense Trail. And we did it all. And that's what it was looking like. Now, we kind of knew we were looking for, this is cutting back in, a chain of villages. Now, the reason the trail went there is that in ancient times, Arabia was covered during the Ice Age with ice, and there's an aquifer there, and there's a mountain range, and all these villages are along the eastern side of the mountain range where the aquifer is. And they can drill wells. They had to dig these wells in antiquity, and they maintained them. Then they used it to grow crops, to make money off of the caravaneers. You know, it's the economics of the place. But these villages had farms. If you go to Egypt, Ramesses II, back that far, this area is called Hajar, these villages. As you speak Arabic, that means farms. Nigel Groom, who is the world's expert on Arabic topography, place names. These are the other spellings in Arabic of Hajar. They all mean, quoting him directly, a fertile piece of land. Piece and part are synonyms. Nephi said they traveled in the most fertile parts. That was the name of the place. It's that only those villages is where the frankincense trail went, the trail Lehi would have taken, the fertile parts. A curious little thing here, these villages were called Mushaharin by Muhammad in his writings, mean the fertile parts of land. And it must have been the most fertile because he charged those villages 25% more tax than anywhere else in his land because they were the most fertile of all the farms. Okay, I'm kind of getting out of time. I just want to take you, the trail gets, of course, a lot worse in the south. Is there a land bountiful? That's Arabia from the air, that dark spot where the monsoons go. Nephi says they went to a place called Bountiful. We're 21 miles from the Indian Ocean. We are following the frankincense trail of antiquity. Now, you know, lots of wild fruit. That's 21 miles away, 15 miles away. Still very barren. 8 miles away from the Indian Ocean. Oh my gosh, my slide of Scotland got misplaced. Okay. Was there a bountiful? Because there's anti-Mormons who come out and say, hey, there's no such thing as bountiful. That's 6 miles away. Here's where the trail came. Stopped at Korori. That's the harbor of Korori. I wish I had an hour to talk to my brethren in the Navy. Our family's Navy, by the way. Okay. You'd appreciate more than anybody what meant to cross the oceans in antiquity and what Nephi needed in terms of resources to get there. The anti-Mormons know this. Where can he find hardwoods? There are none. Impervious hardwoods or softwoods. They're impervious in Oman. Besides, they're weak. You need a keel for a ship. You need a mast for a ship. You need main spars. Where do you get teak wood to build a ship with? That harbor in the year 2000, which is kind of fun too because all this research is coming out right now. This harbor in the year 2000 was designated as this ancient port here where they used to the frankincense ships used to go out, was selected as given the status of a World Heritage Site by the UN because it represented one, if not the greatest economic port activity in the ancient world. That was the richest place in the world. Ships from as far back as 3000 BC were traded in that port. The shipbuilding industry was going on there. How did Nephi do it? Where did he get the teakwood? Where do you think the Indians came? They need the frankincense. They brought teakwood. It's been documented they've been trading teakwood since the year 2000 BC. He needed those hardwoods. Now, all those things were found there at that one place. And isn't it interesting that that's the only trail? Why did the Lord tell Lehi to go, you know, cross the wilderness? There was a reason. The captains, the Greek, if you look at the Greek logs where they teach their captains how to sail in the Indian Ocean, because it's tricky. You got to use the monsoon winds. It says, during the winter time where there's no wind, take your ships to this harbor and winter there. They learned that from the Arabs way before. How did Nephi learn how to sail a ship? You guys in the Navy who have experience sailing a large sailing ship, he couldn't get out of the harbor unless he knew those skills. Okay, how did he master those? You don't think the curious Nephi didn't sit there at their knees saying, hey, could you give me a few lessons and a few hints? They are the only sailors in the world in antiquity who could sail across the oceans because they knew how to navigate. We know Nephi knew how to navigate because he said they were in a storm and they were driven back 4 days. Liahona didn't tell you your position, did it? It told you the direction to go. He knew how to navigate by the stars, and only the Omanis knew that. I think our greatest research and contribution to the Book of Mormon archaeology is this harbor here. It is incredible. Every resource he needed. I'm going to wrap this up real fast. Especially sails. Can you imagine Nephi going to his wife and saying, honey, I know there's no cotton around here. There are no trees in any instance. Could you please make me some sails? How many sets of sails did they need in antiquity? Using the old fabrics, sails stretch, sails tear. Must have at least 10 sets of sails, I would imagine, to make it to the New World. It has been shown only in the last year that cotton grew here in antiquity. It's also been shown that the Indians brought cotton cloth to that harbor to trade for the frankincense. Dr. Zeres Jarns from Southern Missouri University. If someone tells you that the Book of Mormon story of First Nephi is infeasible, they do not know what they're talking about, because it is a complete, total harmony, complete harmony with the geography and the history of Arabia. Complete harmony. If you take that frankincense trail, we can give you the GPS points, you will find everything Nephi talks about. Now, what's the probability that Joseph Smith could have guessed any one of these things? There's a river after the U.S. Geological Survey says, oh, there are no rivers or streams that flow year-round. I'll tell you, that might not be the Valley of Lemuel, but if you talk to the Mormons over in Saudi Arabia, they'll say, well, I know, but that's Valley of Lemuel State Park. It's a popular camping spot for Mormons now, okay, by the river that flows all year long. It's been flowing for the last 10 years. What's the probability Joseph Smith could have guessed that there's a river in Arabia exactly 3 days in, and then that river empties into the Red Sea? 1 million to 1, maybe? Now you got to realize that no Westerner had traveled any part of that trail until Charles Doty in the year 1876. Let's make it easy on the prophet who we honor this year. How good a translator was he? How accurate was he? Let's just say, though, he guessed it. And we will say that we'll give him 2-to-1 odds he could have guessed that. How about a place called Shazer? Existed the very next halt on the frankincense trail, the first place he could have pitched his tents and gone hunting in the mountains. Let's give him 2-to-1. Most fertile parts, a trail east, a place called Nahom, place where Bowood was, place where he could find all the resources to build a ship. 81 things, assertions are made by Nephi, some explicit, some implicit. How could Joseph Smith have got them right? Not only right, but in the right order, in the right direction, the right place names. Trying to get 81 things right. Thank goodness none of us go to Las Vegas, but think of the odds. 2-to-1, 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 2-to-1 each time getting it right. What are the odds? It's something like 29 to the 49th power. It's a number I can't even pronounce it. I don't think they have a name for that kind of a number. To give you an idea of how impossible it was for Joseph Smith to have guessed these things, That is a picture taken of the universe by the Hubble Space Telescope of the universe. What part of the universe is that? If I hold this dime up at arm's length, it's equivalent to the eye of President Roosevelt. That's the piece of space we're looking at. Those are not stars, those are galaxies. It is estimated by scientists that in the known universe there are 100 billion galaxies in the world, in the universe. And the average number of stars in each universe is 100 billion. If you take 100 billion galaxies times 100 billion stars, think of that number. That's a lower number than the probability of Joseph Smith trying to get the Book of Mormon correct, to have guessed it, given 2-to-1 odds. Given 2-to-1 odds. Brothers and sisters, the Book of Mormon is true. It's all out there. And I tell an anti-Mormon, I say, hey, do you want the GPS coordinates? Now, to us, we're just curious people. Tell you the truth. We don't have an agenda. But I've been touched by receiving two emails from brethren who have been married to LDS women who have had missionaries over at their houses, you know, for like decades, who said, your work is interesting. I'm now a member of the church. 2 weeks ago, first time ever, I received an email from a guy who says, I've been an anti-Mormon for years. This is very interesting. Could you send me some more information? I'm genuinely interested in learning about the Book of Mormon now. Thank you for allowing me to share with you this little brief introduction to what we've been doing, and really from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for protecting us and my friends in the Middle East. And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.